Not that's natural. The sun happens to be an extremely...
Repeater, time out.
It happens to be an extremely weak signal. KD2, Romeo, Romeo, Foxtrot, I think it is, T2RIW. Start off with your name, sir, and correct me on your call.
KD2J after that. Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Romeo Echo. Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Romeo Echo. My question is, what makes us believe that we've actually experienced all of the radio frequencies that actually exist if, you know, all we have is our primitive equipment that we use to detect it and to create it? And, you know, that would thereby mean that we also believe in some way that we're just as smart as Mother Nature. Does that make any sense? Not to me, it doesn't.
Don, good question. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, one thing I just wanted to point out about sun noise. We have big satellite dishes here, and a couple times a year, we get something called a sun outage, when the sun lines up exactly with the satellite you're looking at, and the noise that it makes just wipes out the satellite signal. The other thing I wanted to mention is that, how do you create a resonant circuit inside a biological form? Forget about wires, you know. Most biological forms are not rigid that stay exactly in one place unless you're talking about bone. But even still, they move a little bit. It's RIWKJJ.
Now, the usual method we use to make a LC circuit, an inductor capacitor circuit, or a cavity resonator, all of these require very high conductivity materials of a very specific layout. And even if you've got a resonator that's going to resonate at the RF frequency, you now need a detector. Detector usually is a semiconductor diode to make a diode out of protoplasm. The degree of difficulty here is so high, and Mother Nature takes, in most cases, the easy path at that time. And we're discussing a very difficult path. It took mankind hundreds of years to develop these radio circuits. And we weren't limited at all by the equipment, by the materials, the raw materials that we can use. A biological animal is very limited as to what raw materials it can gather and put it in just the right form. So to generate radio within a biological instrument, biological animal, is very difficult, I think. Over to you, Roy. And drag your feet, because there's probably more people making comments. AC2GS with some delay, K2LIW.
ORE.
ORE, go ahead.
I'm still missing something. I'm not really sure what I'm missing, but I'm missing something. It's like, we know, as far as I know, we know that insects, for instance, communicate very well and work together. They, you know, have special jobs that they take on, and they know when to do the job and all that stuff. Are we really believing that they just know intrinsically, or, you know, I guess as a reflex or whatever, when these jobs get done? Or is there somehow a belief that any of you can have that they actually do communicate and we just don't know how?
I think there have been quite a few studies as to how does an ant colony communicate, for instance. There's a lot of instinct built into that animal. He knows what his specific job is, if he's a worker, if he's a queen, or whatever. And when it comes to indicating to the rest of the hive where is the desirable equipment, ants will drop a chemical trail that the rest of the guys will follow. So they have ways of communicating chemically and optically. In other words, by a bumblebee dancing the right way, he's giving indication as to what direction to go with reference to the sun and how far to go to find that particular honey patch. So mankind studying these insects have discovered an awful lot of the methods of communication. And so I think, Colin, you'd like to believe that there's other methods that they're communicating that we don't know about. Is that true? KD2ORE, K2LIW?
That is pretty much what I'm saying. Like, we don't know all of the methods that they use to communicate. And, you know, we're somehow believing that metallic antenna are the only
repeater, timeout,
receive communication. But I'm not believing that at all.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Understand. We heard all your words, by the way. Go ahead, Eric.
By the same token, animals communicate by way of chemistry or by way of pheromones. But the interesting thing is, you know, for as much as we want nature to do something that is archaic by nature's standards, when we try to do things that nature does, I mean, consider the fact that you have this, like, supercomputer that uses chemistry, it uses electricity to make it happen, it makes it start, which brings us to another point. The communication, as we know it, requires a certain level of intelligence. So even the bumblebee that does a dance that gives them location of where to find food, that is an intelligence. And you think about the size of its brain and what it goes through, and you look at Watson, which is this huge computer system. It barely comes even close to a amoeba in terms of its ability to duplicate what nature does. So it's a whole interesting thing. But the electronic part and the whatever it makes us communicate, whatever it makes us understand, two different worlds.
AC2GS. Getting back to ORE with the frequency of electromagnetic waves. I think we pretty much defined electromagnetic waves as having an innate frequency and wavelength, and if you're able to kind of give it that identifier, all you have to do is give the frequency, and you can run up the electromagnetic spectrum close to infinity when a lot of other things kind of complicate life. So I think we pretty much know electromagnetic waves as the spectrum from zero to close to infinity. And, you know, as everyone's been kind of saying, RF is just darn difficult. But let me take a far lesser example than RF transmission and receive biology. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, how many of you people have seen a blue living thing at all? Not a purple living thing, but a blue living thing.
One whitey white.
I think certain feathers are blue. Go ahead, Paul. You know who you are, Roy. Are certain feathers blue? However, are they really blue, or is it a whole bunch of whole spacings that give us the perception of blue? You've got it, Roy.
Yes, that's the trick. Now, Hank, I think, wanted to say something.
You asked if I've ever seen a blue living thing, and yes, I've seen blue lobsters in Maine. They don't have a lot of them, but they do exist. And actually, the state of Maine keeps them in a tank when they're caught to show people.
Okay, very well. But the problem is that, surprisingly, it's not quite simple for solution to figure out how to make blue dye. Most of the things that we think of as blue, as Dick mentioned, have no blue dye or blue pigment anywhere in them. If you drill down through an electron microscope, what you'll end up seeing are these incredible, almost metamaterial structures which produce interference patterns that mimic, that reflect blue light and absorb the rest. So it's an interference metamaterial. It's not a blue dye, because evolution apparently finds it incredibly difficult to just evolve a blue dye. It's easier for evolution to create a metamaterial of interference prism. Across the blade of, say, a Morphos butterfly, which is a very beautiful blue-green iridescent color. But again, if you drill down the electron microscope, there's no blue anywhere in it. It's just a bunch of little pyramids and pokes that do interference effects. Tank?
What about blue mold?
I just wanted to know about the blue lobster. Is it really blue, or is it, again, one of those metamaterials?
I tend to think it's a metamaterial. There are a few actual bluish life forms. They're very rare, very few and far between. There's even a biblical source for one of them. In thousands of years ago, the prayer shawls of Hebrews was supposed to be dyed, one of the fringes, with a sea animal that was actually blue, and it was able to give that a blue dye. But they've forgotten what animal that was. They have some guesses of what it might have been, but they are exceedingly rare. Blue dyes and the color blue was a very, very weird color back in medieval times. If you ask people about the sky and the ocean, they would give you very strange names for what that color might have been. They really didn't think too much of blue. Blue is one of the last primary colors that people really took seriously.
What about blue mold?
Well, I don't... Well, yeah, there's blue cheese and such. I don't know. Is that truly blue, or is that kind of a blue-green?
Oh, I don't accept that. In chemistry, a lot of blue dyes are made from copper.
True, and one of the most ancient blue dyes that did exist in the world, but it was not well known, was Egyptian blue, which is a combination of copper and cobalt, I believe, and some oxides mixed together. So even in the ancient world, there were blue things, and there was cobalt blue glass, but I don't know. I think the problem was that there weren't enough different shades of blue for people to take it seriously, and they just kind of said, you know, it's the sky color, whatever. Go back to Homer and the Iliad. When he talks about the ocean, he doesn't really call it blue. He calls it blood.
There's pieces of chemistry that will give you a blue color, copper and cobalt and whatever, but maybe very few chunks of biology will collect those materials because maybe to a biological animal, those are toxic substances. Is that a possible explanation, Roy?
It might be of that, but again, usually the problem is that evolution doesn't just kind of create something out of nothing. Evolution tends to like to repurpose things. So they'll take something that it already has and twist it around a little bit here, a little bit there, and get it closer to what it's looking for. So that's why structural changes are far easier to do than actually designing the biochemistry of creating a organic dye that's not generally present in any primitive organisms. I mean, you have blue-green algae, but again, that's not blue, that's kind of blue-green. The problem is that some of these evolution devices that sound great requires way too much effort for even evolution.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I just found a group in San Diego. It's a college in San Diego, and they got funded, I don't know how many millions of dollars from the government, from DARPA, you know, that's the group that Defense Advanced Research Project. You know, they always put money toward this, these high-risk, unsolvable problems. And this group is right now presently trying to find some kind of biological cells. They think they have, you know, they're working on it. I'll send you the email. But, I mean, this, they're actually looking for some kind of cells that would be able to do that. DARPA would be able to use, they said, biological substances in the future to, you know, to utilize the RF waves, you know. So it's one of those things. The .edu website, so it doesn't look like a phony thing. Back to you.
AC2GS. Okay, so, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I'm certainly not telling anyone that it's impossible to do. I don't have the faintest idea how you would go about it, and evolution hasn't really come up with any good ideas yet. You know, maybe give things another 1 billion or 2 billion years, and they'll suss this one out too. You know, who knows? Maybe they'll even be able to send FT-8. That would be great. But I was just kind of, you know, that was the guy's question, and the problem is that evolution isn't magic. It can only do so much over so much time, and again, it tends to prefer to repurpose old ideas. It likes to reuse old ideas with twists rather than scrap them and come up with a completely new idea.
Roy, they're in petri dishes. And it looks like they're aiming RF out to see if this biological material moves around. They've never found anything so far, so we'll see.
Okay, I wish them good luck. I think Wesley had something to say.
Interject. Okay. Question for you. Pistol shrimp makes mechanical energy conversion to radio waves. We have a light. In your field, if you are very close to the transmitter, you can feel the temperature, so the heat can damage your brain. My question is, the prey is disabled in the case of pistol shrimp by electrical energy that is converted to heat, or by mechanical energy that is converted to heat. Enter again.
You didn't talk about plants. You know, there are plants that are blue, like indigo.
Okay, but that's not blue.
Oh, it's not pure blue, but I guess it's a little bit of a greenish blue, but that's what they used to make blue dyes from.
Yes, that's true, and over time, chemistry has a lot of different blue dyes. They're just not found in nature. They're found in laboratories.
I suppose you could say that, because you're taking the leaves of the plant and letting them dry out.
Yeah, you're using them as a precursor in a series of chemical reactions to get you to the proper dye, but, you know, by themselves, they just sit there and aren't blue.
Yeah, I gotcha. I'm thinking like there's some flowers, but they're not pure blue. They're blue something, or they're blue green, or they're blue purple.
Yes, that's the rub. They're always blue something else, and so the only thing that in the olden days, I guess with the exception of Egyptian blue and cobalt glass blue, was the ocean and the sky. And so people just took it for granted. Getting back to Wesley's question, I would say that it's primarily the shock wave of mechanical energy, because that's the initiating force for the light and the heat and everything else. So, you know, that came before anything else. So I would say that it's a primary effect of mechanical energy.
So you're saying that the mechanical energy is directly converted to heat, and light is just a side effect in form of electrical energy, and what is the energy balance then?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by the energy balance. The primary source of energy created both the heat and the light is the shock wave produced from mechanical energy. So it went from mechanical energy to light somewhat, to kinetic energy somewhat, then the light got absorbed back into kinetic energy, and you were left with a lot of excess kinetic energy that had was created from the mechanical energy, which was created by the food that the animal ate in the first place.
So if you were able to assess, percentage-wise, how much of that energy is converted to radio wave, to electromagnetic energy, and how much of that is reconversion of that light to heat and to action?
I think ultimately in its sea environment, all of it inevitably ends up being absorbed back and left as waste heat. Because I don't really see the ocean lighting up at night. So it doesn't get out from the ocean, so it gets absorbed through something, and that's just more waste heat.
The temperature of thermal luminescence created by shrimp differs, but pistol shrimp, based on literature, is a few times hotter than the surface of the sun. So by that, we see that the reconversion of that electromagnetic wave to heat should happen from that source, not only from the mechanical energy that is converted to longitudinal wave. And to exchange.
AC2GS. The way I look upon it as the primary source for this entire phenomena started as mechanical energy. There's nothing inside that animal that creates light. What it was, it created a shock wave. The shock wave created a bubble that was compressed and created a great deal of heat, which created luminescence. So, the mechanical forces were the underlying cause of it all. So you want to pick it apart. Well, at one point it was mechanical, but then it turned into light. But then the light got absorbed into thermal energy. So, energy just moves from one place to the other, one form of the other. It can't be created, it can't be destroyed.
So now it looks like we don't have exclusion, we have a mutual existence, or we have just one or the other. Mechanical energy with no chemical luminescence present in the operation of the shrimp.
Yes, in the case of the shrimp, it's not going through chemiluminescence. It's going through pure gravitation and shockwave phenomena. It's kind of all physics. With most biological units inside, it's usually chemiluminescence and usually ATP. I mean, if you want to fudge it, you could say that the energy that the shrimp used for the mechanical energy to trigger the shock wave was created from his stores of ATP internally. So everything biologically, unfortunately, tends to all come back to ATP.
Thank you very much.
If you've ever gone swimming at nighttime and your eyes are fully dark adapted and you're in seawater, and you wave your arms rapidly through the water, underneath the water, you see light being created. What's the mechanism that's doing that, if you happen to know, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW.
gosh, you asked me something that I don't know. I know there are all kinds of interesting luminescence tricks. If you go into a dark room and you take a piece of tape and stick it together and then pull it apart real fast, it produces light. But I can't tell you for a fact of what's going on in the ocean, but I will Google it until I find something.
And when, why do you want with an answer?
You've got it, Hank. Bring us up to speed on this one.
The bioluminescence is from algae, and you can see it behind a lot of boats as they travel at night in the ocean.
Okay. You're giving it a name, bioluminescence. What's really happening? Are you mixing oxygen with the water and there's some kind of an animal under there that gives off light when he sees the oxygen? That's a guess.
I believe it's, again, an ATP-ADP reaction that occurs when you agitate the plant.
So I wasn't smart enough to look for that. You're saying that when you're looking at a powerboat at nighttime, behind the powerboat, you'll see luminescence in the water, is what I think you're saying, Hank. Go ahead.
Well, I've never seen it behind a powerboat, but I've certainly seen it a lot of times behind a sailboat.
So you're seeing the light at the bow, along the length, or at the stern. What part of the sailboat is creating the light, Hank?
I can't tell you where it's created, Dick, but I can tell you that you see it in a V-shape along the wake of the boat. Remember, a sailboat doesn't produce the same type of wake as a powerboat. Most powerboats climb over the bow wave and they plane, and most sailboats are a displacement hull and they go much more slowly through the water.
You're talking about phytoplankton, which is an algae.
Algae first. I didn't call it phytoplankton, but I did say it was an algae. And one whitey-white.
What's the mechanism by which that light's being created, Eric?
It's basically the same reaction as what you get in a pilot light.
By the way, there's a lot of bioluminescent animals out there in the ocean. Mollusks, worms, crustaceans, all kinds of interesting things. Glow a little bit in the dark, thanks to good old ATP.
Any of those animals that make light, are they ever doing it by any other process, Eric? I mean, Roy?
I would seriously doubt it. ATP is kind of a fundamental storage molecule in most cell biology. So again, since evolution just kind of repurposes things, it would kind of not be very efficient if it had to reinvent the wheel. So, you know, it might go into some other structures along the way, but I think if you branch it back, someplace, somewhere, is an ATP going to ADP. It's a phosphate being knocked off a simple ATP molecule, ultimately.
Like the mitochondria, it's the energy system for the living cell.
Yes, it's loads of fun, biochemistry. I particularly like the carnitine shuttle.
Yeah, but then again, when we talk about photosynthesis, that's the basic process that works.
That's it working in the opposite direction, where you store up the energy, the light that on the photosynthesis, and eventually it works its way to phosphorylate the ADP. The ATP then goes into the mechanism that builds up, breaks down carbon dioxide and oxygen and all that wonderful stuff, rearranges the atoms a bunch, and lo and behold, you have glucose.
I think they taught that in high school. That was always an interesting process. And yeah, you make your basic sugars, which powers everything.
You know, there are other things that power things. When you're stuck and you run out of sugar and starch, Your body can metabolize proteins and can metabolize fats. Some organs don't particularly enjoy the experience and take a little bit of time to get used to it. So the brain really, really likes to burn sugar. It doesn't prefer fat, but if you're stuck and there's nothing else left, it'll take anything.
Then you end up with a lactic acid buildup.
No, as long as it's got carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, it's going to turn into sugar anyway. It doesn't matter what it starts out as.
Well, but things can't do that, unfortunately. Plants can take the raw materials, rearrange them, and turn them into sugars. We can break starches down to sugars, we can break glycogen down to sugars, and we can burn sugar. But if you give a human cell all the raw material and all the energy in the world, it doesn't have the faintest idea how to make a sugar molecule.
That sounds pretty weird.
Biologically necessary. We've lost a lot of things that we used to have because it was just as good not having it because you ate things that produced it. That's the whole thing behind vitamins. Vitamins are materials that we can't synthesize ourselves, so we just eat it from other animals that can. Evolutionarily, the people who lost that ability didn't suffer, and so reproduced, and there were a lot of them.
I just want to remind you, your deviations are a little bit big, and you leave holes in what you're saying, but I got to go up there and change it. The filter in the IF is too narrow.
Is there an animal, Roy, that can synthesize a sucrose or a sugar?
As far as I can recall, it's a kind of a lost for the animal kingdom. I don't recall a single case being mentioned anyplace. You know, there might be something really weird out there, but primarily a plant kingdom ability at this point.
There are chemotrophs that live in by ocean vents.
Hey, that's true, but they're not quite animals. They're their own thing. So yeah, I guess that. But that's a real esoteric group of animal of life.
Are you saying, Roy, that life near an ocean vent is sort of halfway between plant and animal?
Well, you know, pretty much by definition, plants are able to change light into energy and into food. These creatures kind of break the definition of all the kingdoms by being able to directly tap chemical bonds that most life forms have no access to. So I don't know where they fit on the kingdom, but I'm assuming their own little special separate group. It's a good question, though.
And because they're at the bottom of an ocean where there's extremely high hydrostatic pressure, I guess it's considered an extremophile.
Well, yeah, I mean, not only are the pressures extreme, but of times they're living off of highly corrosive chemicals that most life forms would just die from. I mean, no one really thinks of it anymore, but one of the things that really killed off a lot of life on this planet was when plants started to free the oxygen. Oxygen can be a very toxic material for life forms that don't breathe oxygen. And so anaerobic organisms died a lot during the time that plants started to pump out the oxygen for us in the future.
Bye-bye.
What was that, George? mean trilobites?
Trilobites and trilobites, billions of them.
Okay, but they weren't anaerobes. They were aerobic. They breathed oxygen that was dissolved in the ocean.
Tube worms down at the deep holes and the volcanic vents. Those things are based on sulfur, aren't they?
I don't know if they know a lot about them, because it seems that every time that I've ever seen any documentaries, by the time that they take them away from there, there isn't that much left to experiment on. So, again, I'm not that familiar with their metabolism and where they kind of fit on the phylums and kingdoms and what have you. But I'm kind of sure that their genetics is probably very unique, considering what they live on and where they live on.
I remember seeing one documentary. I mean, we passed through lots of documentaries here. That it was the sulfur in the water, that they somehow or other managed to synthesize that, or use it to synthesize the oxygen that they need.
I don't think it's the sulfur that creates the oxygen. I mean, the only thing that you can do is break down the oxygen and oxides to get free oxygen. But, you know, sulfur chemistry, yeah, again, that's a very unusual type of biological chemistry. There's, you know, animals, living things can manipulate sulfur to a degree, but I don't think they can get too much energy other than these extremophiles. So extremophiles is a really interesting but esoteric and little understood little branch of the living tree that's biology.
Yeah, well, that's an unusual place with the temperatures and the pressure. And there's also some weird-looking eyeless fish, and you can't imagine that there's much dissolved oxygen all the way down there. So, but then again, I don't know. But it's also in a volcanic vent, so, you know, everything the Earth is made out of is coming out of that same vent.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the first time a biologist saw that type of life, they were deeply confused. Because up until, you know, seeing it, no one had any theories that were anything close to it.
All right, that's it for me.
Okay, so did we burn out on this particular subject? Anyone have any points that they want to have clarified? Okay, I'll take the second question that the guy in the chat room asked me. That should go shorter. He wanted to know why the photosphere of the sun wasn't mapped, and there were locations on it the same way that the moon is very nicely mapped, and there's landmarks and names for all kinds of wonderful things. And why hasn't anyone bothered to do that with the sun? So what's the opinion for that one?
N2HVR.
Yes, Nick.
Hey, Roy, how are you? Nice to talk to you and hear you. Isn't it because the sun is really, it's not solid, it's a fluid or a gas, so how can you map stuff when it's continuously changing?
Yeah, right. You are. It's actually a plasma. It's an ionized gas. It floats and flows and moves all over the place. Now there are some gas giants that have such large storms that they leave landmarks. So you know you can see the storms of the major gas planets. But with the sun, it is so violent and so active that the sunspots come and sunspots go, and sunspots have really gone lately. And very few in the way of landmarks in general, and they don't stick around. So although scientists have a way of describing places on the sphere, they don't really have landmarks on them because there's no long-term landmarks to be had. I mean, unless someone else has a better reason for why it's not mapped.
Another difficulty is that the sun rotates in a peculiar manner. It rotates faster at the equator than it does at the poles, so it's continuously winding itself up, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a problem. I mean, fortunately, there's nothing really there that requires you to map certain locations. I've seen reports, especially reports for amateurs about sunspot activity, where they've discussed and they've shown pictures of sunspots and such, and they give vague locations, but just the vaguest. I don't know if the specialists have a much more precise way of defining regions, but it's just a moving ball of plasma. It's kind of problematic to map it in any way, shape, or form that I could conceive of. So that question really didn't take any time at all. Okay, let's drop back into my grab bag. I'll hopefully Paul won't mind if I take the next, say, 15 minutes with the grab bag. And I have a term for you guys. I would like you to answer me if you think it's a legitimate scientific or if I'm just trying to kid you guys. And the term is a Kugel blitz. So does anyone think there is actually something called a Kugel blitz in the field of science? And then what might it be?
G-E-L-B-L-I-T-Z.
No, I think you meant the Googleplex, maybe?
Right, Googleplex, yeah. No, it's not that, okay.
Okay, anyone out there just want to take any kind of a guess? Anyone who kind of maybe took first-year German?
I'm missing the first letter. You keep cutting out. Is it a G as in golf?
It's a K as in kilo. Once again, it is a K as in kilo. Kugel.
Sounds like food. Okay, now I know what you're saying, but no, I'm out. I passed WS2S.
YDY, bucket lightning? I'm not quite sure where you're going with that.
Okay, I think if you take it from the German, which unfortunately doesn't solve the problem but gets you somewhere close to it, is I think Kugel means round, and that's why it's used as a food. People who know Yiddish know Kugel as something you eat, not something that you study. So the term in German means round lightning, but that's not really what Kugel Blitz is, but that's...
Kugel is bucket, K-U-G-L-E, if I'm understanding it correctly, N1YDY.
Okay, I never took German, so I simply took the entry that somewhere along the line they made it sound like it was ball lightning in German, but that's not what it is. Kugelblitz is a very interesting theoretical phenomenon. As we've talked about in the past, light has inertial mass. It has pressure, it has all kinds of things that we tend not to like to think about light having. A Kugel blitz is setting up enough light to bang into each other, and Wesley is going to say light doesn't bang into each other, it doesn't interact with itself, but still, if you can collect enough inertial mass light into one area where it reaches its critical mass, it turns into a black hole. And when you do that, that's called a Kugel blitz.
Hey,
Carter.
N1YDY?
Yes, Hank.
Kind of makes sense if you think about it. From a literal translation, bucket lightning, so you're putting enough light energy together that it falls into a bucket, into a hole.
Yes, it makes sense. Unfortunately, again, most people are going to look at this and say, gee, light. How could light make a black hole? Because it doesn't weigh anything. But such is the nature of light, unfortunately. But I thought it's a great term. I mean, it sounds like some kind, you know, if you know Yiddish, it sounds like something you would eat. You know, because, you know, people would say, would think of it more like a cool blintz, which is definitely something one would eat. But I just thought it was an interesting term. I have another little question for you guys that probably you've heard before, but we'll try it again and see if anyone has any opinion one way or the other. Glass. Everyone's seen glass. Everyone owns glass. Is glass a solid or is glass a liquid?
Fluid, isn't it? In one way, anyway.
Okay, Hank, so you say it's a liquid. Is there any kind of thin experience that you can point to that would sort of lean towards that position?
If you look at the older glass panes as they were individually cast, you can see sometimes they have a pore spot in the center where they actually had to cut it as they blew it where they cast it.
Okay, so you're saying that what happens is old glass is thicker at the bottom than the top.
That may be a theory, but is it really confirmable? The fact that it appears to be an amorphous, very dense, very viscous fluid, when you heat up glass, it doesn't have a melting temperature. It has a melting range. And as you change the temperature over that range, you get a change in viscosity. I don't think it has a crystalline structure where it really forms into what we conventionally call a solid. Is any of that right, Roy, over to you, K2LIW?
AC2GS. Yes, I mean, the trick to this is that glass is actually, unfortunately, a solid. It is not a crystalline solid. It is something called, as you mentioned, an amorphous solid. So, solid glass is truly solid. It is not a viscous liquid. It is not flowing in the window pane. The reason why people have noticed that the window panes are a little bit thicker on the bottom than the top is not because they were perfectly even when they were put in and viscosity kind of drew them down. What happened is they simply weren't able to manufacture perfectly flat sheets of glass. So they tended to put the heavier, thicker portions of glass on the bottom of whatever they paint. So the glass, unfortunately, is an amorphous solid. It is not a liquid. It is not a highly viscous liquid, and it doesn't flow. Question is, what about common pitch? Is common pitch a solid or a liquid?
Are you talking about the kind of pitch that's used for grinding a telescope parabolic mirror?
I'm not quite sure if that's used for that. I'm thinking of the tarry material.
Yes, it is a tarry material that they use for the final steps of grinding a parabolic mirror.
Okay, so be it. So the question at hand is much in the vein of glass. Is that a solid? Is that a very viscous liquid? Is it just a regular liquid? How would you describe pitch?
As you slowly heat up pitch, it becomes softer and softer, more and more malleable. Once again, it appears to be an amorphous substance that has a melting range as opposed to a melting temperature. Over to you, Roy.
Well, probably what I should say at the top of that question was at room temperature, is solid or a liquid, because, you know, there are different things that are solid at one temperature and liquid at the other. And the trick about pick at room temperature is that it is a highly viscous liquid. And if you have any doubts about it, there is actually an experiment that streams on video on the web from a university in Australia that actually has a beaker full of pitch being poured out in incredible slow motion over years. And you can actually watch the pitch just sit there and think. And the last time the pitch had a drip come out of it, the poor guy who was part of that experiment had gone to the bathroom or something, and he missed it. Pitch is actually a liquid at room temperature. It's a highly viscous one. It's sort of what you think, what most people think glass is.
Could I operate glass at a temperature that's right at the threshold between the liquid and solid?
Well, as you mentioned, the problem is that the phase transition for amorphous liquid, amorphous solids, is not as sharp as crystalline. You might oversaturate, undersaturate type of things that then suddenly give them a little force or a little dirt on the side and they'll crystallize. But there's a range of the amorphous solid kind of form. So it gets kind of fuzzy around the edges. You know, there are obvious points where it's a liquid that you can manipulate, and there are obvious points at room temperature and even above where it's just an amorphous solid. But there's that fudgy little area in between where it's neither or.
Could I put a blob of glass inside of a porcelain pitcher, and I operate that pitcher at a particular temperature, where I pour the glass out of there over a period of years? So if I choose the right temperature, couldn't I also do that with glass?
Well, the question would be, how does the viscosity change over temperature, and how finely can you control the temperature? So my guess would be the range at which the viscosity would be so high that it would take years for the thing to drip would probably not be a very easy thing to engineer.
It's possible that glass and pitch have similar properties in this area, just that their flowing temperature is different. And so pitch happens to be still flowing at a temperature where we live, and glass will only flow at a temperature higher than where we live.
Yeah, I would assume that pitch under a certain temperature will form some form of amorphous solid as well. That's why, in retrospect, I mentioned that room temperature. The temperatures and pressure is very important as well. People will always forget pressure, but if you lower the pressure, water can boil at almost, you know, any kind of reasonable temperature. So you have to put in pressure, temperature, in order to have it make any sense on a phase change diagram. Okay, I don't want to wreck Paul's SpaceNet report. He's going to talk about the Falcon, the heavy Elon Musk's beautiful rocket that went off and landed. So I just want to ask people if they have questions, and to remind them once again, the mailbag address is mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. So if you have any further questions, feel free to tell me. Otherwise, I will hand it over to Paul.
Net time complete.
Okay, I don't hear anybody, Roy, so I'll take it.
Very good. Take it away, Paul. Thank you very much, everyone.
And that guy, Elon Musk, he is something else, Paul. Boy, he pulled off a beautiful experiment. You got it, Paul.
Yes, and he's a genius, and I just hope he keeps his health, because I hope he's got other people that could take over if he's sick or something, because every day he comes out with a new way of doing things. And just to say one thing about Roy's topic about the sun, keep an eye on this August. We're going to have a flight going to the sun. It's going to go less than 4 million miles off the photosphere, and it's going to be launched by a Delta IV rocket. It's called the Parker satellite. But again, it's going to go on a Delta IV heavy rocket, so it's going to have a similar configuration to this Delta heavy that the Falcon Heavy had the other day on February 6th when that took off. That kind of a look. It's got three big boosters, but it's the put together by the United, the UAE, United. Let me drop it. I'm going to time out here. Okay. It's going to be, you know, it's put together by Lockheed and Boeing, and then they're the ones that make the Delta IV Heavy. And the thrust on there is a lot less than what Elon Musk did. You know, but, you know, not quite half, but, you know, close to it. The only breaking news I really have was a flight that was supposed to take off yesterday morning, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was the Soyuz Progress rocket that was going to be launched from Kazakhstan, and it's a Progress rocket. It's a cargo vehicle, and it was scrubbed at last couple of seconds. Similar to what happened in October, they tried to do the same type of thing. What they're trying to do is launch the rocket from Kazakhstan and get to the space station in 3 hours or 3.5 hours. To do that, the space station has to be directly over or just shy of the launch pad at the time of launch, and they'll be able to do that. And they tried it last time, it didn't work, and this time they tried it. Usually it takes, they have a quick way of getting there, roughly about 6 to 7 hours. That's the quickest they normally can do it, a couple of orbits. And without that, they have to do 34 orbits, which is roughly 2 days, which is a long time for astronauts to spend in a spacecraft. So they're trying to cut that time down to 6 hours. They've been out once with astronauts down to the 6.5 hour time. They're trying to get it down to 3.5 hours. This way you spend less time in that cramped, very cramped Soyuz spacecraft, if you ever seen them take off in that thing. Yeah, they do have another module that they climb into with a little bit more space, but it's still tight quarters. So they try to get to the space station as quick as possible. But apparently something went wrong with the computer shut it down, and I'll have to find out exactly what it was. But we don't know yet. They think it's the same thing as what happened in October. But I'll find out and report back probably next week or the week after. Let me drop it. Okay, now the Falcon Heavy story. Yeah, that was launched on Tuesday in the Falcon Heavy configuration. Basically, three Falcon 9s bolted together and then launched as one. The idea was to test this whole system. almost 5 million pounds of trust.